Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Joining us is somebody who is no stranger to our airwaves, and he's probably no stranger to you. Why? Because if you don't know his name, you probably read one of his 55 books. He is the author of The Golan of Brooklyn. He's the author of Rage is Back. He's the author of the award-winning book Angry Black White Boy. He has a series called A Field Guide to Jewish People. He was the screenwriter for the Netflix original film Barry. Barry, like Barack Obama Barry, right? He has an instant award-winning bestseller called Jake the Fake, but most people know him for the book Go to F to Sleep. And here we are, 18 years later, with a new book. And we're talking to Adam Mansbach, the Bay Area's own, and we want to welcome you to the show, Fran. How you doing?
Good to be here, Dave, as always.
You know, you have a new book. I'll let you tell everybody the title of it. You can't use the colorful language that is in the book on the airways, but tell us about this book.
Yeah, no, I'm no stranger to not using that word on the airwaves. I've been practicing for years not using that word on the airwaves. So let me just say that the name of the new book, the sequel to Go the F to Sleep 15 years later, is called Go the F to College.
Now, Go to F to Sleep, I think I have a little bit of a connection with this, right? I happen to be in your home in Philadelphia when you were living there, came out there to do a speaking engagement, and it was me, a couple of friends, you know, some professors. We were all sitting there waiting to have a really in-depth conversation with Adam Mansbach, and you said, I'll be right back. Let me go put my daughter to sleep. And 15 minutes passed, and then 15 minutes became 30 minutes, and then it was 45, and then within an hour, in about an hour and a half, you came back. You were frazzled. You looked frustrated. And you was like, man, she would not go to hell to sleep. And year later came the famous book, Go to F to Sleep. Was that the impetus for it, or had there been many, many moments? And that was just the final straw where we saw you frazzled and really upset with your wonderful daughter.
Oh, man. You know, as I'm listening to you tell that story, my first thought was an hour and a half. That was a good night. Yeah. I mean, when my oldest, I have three daughters, like a farmer in a joke. When my oldest, Vivian, was that age, that would have been about two, sleep was not high on her list of priorities. So it would often take me an hour and a half, 2 hours, 2.5 hours to get this child's brain to kind of like spin down and get her to go to sleep. And, you know, when you're a young parent, the fact that you cannot convince your kid to do this thing that is so essential and so basic, and for many of us, so pleasurable, it really makes you doubt everything. And you see the time slipping away. You realize that this is your only free time. This is your only time to really be an adult, have a conversation, kick it with your friends, drink a glass of wine, chill with your spouse, whatever it might be. And so the blinding rage that sets in is fairly profound. And the paradox that you love this kid to death, but would do anything to get out of that room becomes very real. So that is the situation out of which I wrote Go the F to Sleep. Many, many nights like that.
What would she do, your wonderful daughter, that would not allow her to go to sleep? I mean, certainly you're well-read. You're around a bunch of people. You even were on this show with Waylon Southern and a few others. You did a whole parenting show, a podcast on fatherhood. So it wasn't, and you had like the best guests in the world come through. So it wasn't like you didn't know. It wasn't like you didn't have resources. So what did your daughter do that defied all the methodology and things that you were taught and you know, and shown would be the way?
Well, you know, as I recall, I mean, it's been a while now, this individual is now 18 years old, so it's been a minute. I, of course, remember more clearly the shenanigans that my two younger kids have been pulling off more recently. But, you know, it was just kind of a refusal or an inability to wind down at a given appointed hour. Like, these kids are learning so much and their brains are moving so fast that it's hard for them to kind of downshift. Now, I should add, it did not help that we did not sleep train this child. We were practicing something called attachment parenting. There are kind of two general philosophies around sleep. Sleep training is where you put the kid in their crib, you let them cry it out, and eventually they learn to self-soothe and they'll go to sleep without you. And also they learn that the world is a harsh, cold place full of people who only pretend to love you. The opposite of that, what we were silly enough to practice with Viv, and what I have not practiced since because it is completely ineffective, is something called attachment parenting, which is the opposite. When the kid cries, you run in the room, you pick him up, you cradle him in your arms, you let him know that you love him and that you're here for them and they're never going to be alone. And this ensures that that kid will continue to sleep in your bed until they leave for college.
Wow. We did that. We did that, you know. Oh, wow. Yeah, there was a time where people were saying, you know, if your kid is trying to communicate, you got to go. And, you know, I got to be honest, now that I'm thinking about it, I think my daughter, because my son we didn't do it to, but my daughter we did, I think she learned how to manipulate. You know, I think she became very shrewd, like, let me do this, you know. So we didn't write a book called After Sleep, you know. We should have. But with that being said, let me focus on your daughter, though. First of all, I can't believe it's 18 years, or she's 18 now. What is that like for you, considering for a long time this book, you know, Go to After Sleep, was such a monumental book that people picked it up. You even had Samuel Jackson do the audio. So this thing kind of stayed set in time in terms of us knowing who your daughter is, right? It's like we still see the two-year-old, but she's 18 now. And there's been many iterations that she's gone through and has been a part of. You know, one point she was rapping under the name Jazz Wolf. So what is happening with Viv these days?
I'm happy to say that Viv is still a wonderful, creative inspiration to me. They are graduating from Oakland School of the Arts in a couple of weeks, and they are headed off to Bard College in the fall. Viv studied writing at OSA, so I've been lucky enough to have a kid who I can really, like, talk about craft with and get into the intricacies of what I do. I'm doing a fellowship at Berkeley Rep this summer to develop a work, and I put Viv on my team, so they will be in the room with me. They will be assistant directing as we develop this piece for the stage. And, you know, it's not lost on me that that's a very special relationship and opportunity. And, it, you know, it's certainly not always easy. I would never pretend that parenting is. And, you know, we have our struggles like anybody. But, you know, there's a basic fundamental way in which I just have the deepest respect for who they are. And it's a funny time. It's a fraught time as your kid is preparing to fly the nest. I'm sure we'll talk about this because it's what this new book is about. You know, it's very fraught. Like, when your kid is little, the paradoxes of parenting are kind of simple. It's like what I was saying before. You love them to death, but you want to get out of that room. As you watch your kid get ready to venture out into the world, whether it's college or a job or just moving out, you know, there are other things that come into play. The paradoxes become thornier. It's like I find myself wanting to do all the last-minute parenting I can and like, okay, Viv's out of here in a couple months. What do they not know? What do I have to teach them? I can't send Viv out into the world not knowing how to change a tire. You know, it's like, yeah, I can. Nobody shows up at college a finished person. I'm not a finished person at, you know, 49. You find yourself wanting to, like, let them know that they can always come home, but also that you're turning their room into a gym.
Which you talk about in the book. How does she feel that she's been the subject of, you know, a sentiment that is shared by many parents? She is the poster child for that, Go to After Sleep. Yeah. And knowing that she's been around activists, yourself and others, has she sat down and been like, you know, you've kind of use me or, you know, or say anything of that effect? Do you have to write her a check, you know, or anything like that? Because this book has been your biggest seller.
Yeah. On this one, when I wrote when I told Viv that I was going to write Go the F to College, they were definitely skeptical. They definitely looked askance at me. And I was like, I will run it by you. You are old enough now that I'm not going to write about you without your buy-in, your approval. And when I actually sat down and wrote
the book. Wait a second. She's a Gen Z-er, right? So that means she had union reps. Because that's how my daughters, they have union reps, they had lawyers, they had contracts. You know, you wasn't going to just be able to write that book. And she's very outspoken.
I haven't been hit with the have your people call my people yet. But it might be coming. Viv might snake my agent right out from under me for all we know. But there was a little bit of skepticism. I mean, Viv's relationship to being, you know, the inspiration for Go the F to Sleep, I'm sure is more complicated than I understand. It's certainly not something that they lead with. Like, Viv is not out here in these streets, like, meeting people and being like, hey, how you doing? I'm Viv. I was the inspiration for Go the F to Sleep or anything of that nature. You know, and it's been an interesting road. Like, as Viv pursues writing, at one point a teacher of theirs was like, if you're going to do this, you should change your last name. Which I was like, come on now. Like, it's funny. Kamau Bell, who I'm
writing. The comedian and writer and activist.
Kamau and I each have three kids, and we have a book coming out together. And we talk a lot about parenthood, but we also talk a lot about nepotism. And I can say that I think we are in agreement that we are in favor of it. Like, I didn't do all this work, make all these connections to let my kids have to reinvent the wheel. You know, I'm not out here like donating buildings to schools so they can get admitted, but like the social capital that your parents build up, that's the water in which you swim. That's the world that you know. So, you know, the fact that Viv goes to school and they're like, okay, today's lesson, we're going to read Chinaka Hodge. We're going to read Safia El Hilo. We're going to read Dinez Smith. And she's like, oh, I know all those people. Like, they've been in my house. I've had conversations with them. I hope that that gives her a sense of ease and an understanding that the life of a writer, the life of an artist, it's not some abstraction that that they can't achieve or they can't aspire to. Like, when I was that age, I think for most of us, if we weren't in artistic communities or, as you say, activist communities, there was a lot of mystery around it. And our generation built a lot of infrastructure for kids to allow them to have voices and allow them to succeed. I think about organizations like Youth Speaks in the Bay and the sort of sister organizations across the country that have created this very profound infrastructure for young poets to get up and be heard. You know, we did that because we didn't have that growing up and we wanted to give them that space. And it's a mixed blessing, I think. Those kids have bigger audiences, greater reach, a sense of responsibility, a sense that their voices matter. And all of that is super important. And at the same time, what they don't have is what we had, which is the ability to figure out how to project your voice when no one wants to hear it, how to go into spaces that are fundamentally hostile to you and demand to be heard. They don't necessarily have the same chops with that. The world is different. Maybe they'll learn as they go. But I think that's the trade-off. So for Viv and kids of her generation who've been lucky to grow up around artists and activists, hopefully there's a sense of entitlement in a good way, in the sense that like what they want to talk about matters and people need to listen to them. They are inheriting this world that we have messed up and it's up to them to redeem it.
Do they have a sense of responsibility? And that's a very thin line because some people can take, for example, the connections for granted. And it's not just kids. It could be just people that are friends, right? Yeah, you know, we see and we're friends with a lot of people who are quote-unquote famous, right? They come into the studio. They come into the station. We see them around, right? And then you go to somewhere else, and it's like, you know W. Kamau Bell? And it's like, yeah, he sat on my headphones, you know? He still owes me money for that. You know, so to us, these are just friends. Knowing somebody like you, it's like, you go somewhere, it's a big deal. Here, it's just Adam or Jeff Chang, you know? So it's easy for adults to take our proximity to people who have done big things. So we're here in the land of the Panthers, the land of the free speech movement. So we know our Angela Davises and see the Bobby Seals and so many others that we can take it for granted and not realize that some of those folks are world-renowned iconic figures who have inspired a whole lot. Being the daughter of somebody who has come in contact with all these folks, does she and do her peers feel like they have a sense of responsibility, not so much to carry the torch, but to really, one, not take this for granted, and also to really build upon this in a way that's going to be, that will open doors for more than just them, but for the people around them?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think it's certainly incumbent on us to teach them that. They're not going to come to it on their own. There is a way in which a social conscience ultimately is an outgrowth of very fundamental beliefs and ideas that kids sort of are born with. And what I mean by that is, like, if you have a kid, you're going to hear the phrase, it's not fair, a lot, particularly if they have a sibling. You're going to hear it a million times. But that idea of fairness, it begins as selfish and self-directed. It begins as, she got more than me. Why does my brother have two cookies and I have one? But if you can get in there and work with that idea of fairness and make it outward looking rather than inward looking, make it socially concerned rather than just individually concerned, I believe those are the roots of activism and of empathy and of a kind of care for the world that will lead you down a path and lead to a life where you are interested in making change and you understand the interconnectedness that we all share and the ways in which nobody is free until everybody is free. So fairness begins as being looking out for yourself. But if you can turn that outward, and I think that's our job as parents, as educators, as community members, to take that kernel of outrage that a kid feels when something isn't fair to them and make them think about what it's like when anything isn't fair to everybody.
So that leads us into a very interesting period of time. You know, I teach on the college level, and it really hit me when I was talking to one of my students who, in my mind, I thought they were born in 2001, 2002, and they're like, I was born in 2007. It's like, what? And she's like, you know, my only memory of a president was Barack Obama and now Donald Trump, right? And just having conversations with my students and how they are navigating, you know, what apparently are two extremes, like having Obama in the White House for them is like, oh, okay, well, they don't have any recollection of what that was like to not have somebody who was black in the White House. But to see what they're going through now, I see a lot of people who are tense. I see a lot of people who have not able to really focus. A lack of hope is what I see with a lot of folks that I'm, you know, people that I'm dealing with. Your daughter's a little bit older. Well, no, she's younger than the students that I'm dealing with. How has they and how has she seen this world, just knowing kind of like what the political landscape has been from the time she's born to now versus what we as adults have experienced? We've gone through Clinton and Bush and, you know, the lead up to Obama, and some of us are even older and go back to, you know, the Reagan days, you know, and even, you know, Nixon, right? So there's a lot of things that you can look at and contrast and compare. And some people who are older will look at and say, well, they don't have, you said it, they need to get toughened up. Well, isn't this the toughen up moment right now under this administration? But I'm just curious as to how they process it, and how has she processed, you know, these types of experiences, politically speaking?
Yeah, I mean, when I really stop and think about what a kid who's 18 right now or 20 right now has been through, it's a staggering series of events. I mean, this is the generation that had their education stifled by COVID, that had to be indoors on Zoom for a year, 2 years. They lived through not just the unexpected election of Donald Trump, who, you know, we didn't think he was going to win the first time around. That was shocking. We were assuring our kids. I have a very vivid memory of sitting in our house with friends, watching the election returns coming in. And for months, we'd been assuring Viv that it was all good. that she had nothing to worry about. And to see that all crumble and see the look of horror on the faces of the adults that she trusted and believed in was staggering, you know? I remember driving to school the next day and Viv was like, "Papa, what if Donald Trump just bans books? What if no one's allowed to read anymore?" This was like the worst thing Viv could think of because Viv, you know, loved nothing more at the time than reading at the age of 8. And I was like, yeah, that probably won't happen. But she could sense in my voice the lack of certainty. And so, you know, they've lived through COVID. They've lived through imperialism. They've lived through genocide. They've lived through things on a world stage that are unfathomable.
And the information is much more accessible. We didn't have that. You could still kind of have to go watch the 6 o'clock news and maybe see bits and pieces. Here, you could get it right there on your TikTok feed and everything else.
Yeah, that's true. But also, we live in an age of unreliability and disinformation and deep fakes and AI slop. So increasingly, and I'm sure you see this in your classroom too, the conversations that I'm having are really about where and how are you getting your information? And I've been through many iterations of that conversation with Viv. Like, I remember when Viv first got into podcasts when they were like in middle school and they were coming with these political views. And I was like, hold on, homie, where'd you get that information? Like, not because I necessarily disagree, but because I know you didn't sit down and read it in the New York Times. And she's like, oh, it was a podcast. I'm like, whose podcast is it? Oh, it's Billie Eilish's brother. And I'm like, all right, well, let me look into that real quick and see what kind of political background and sourcing and research Billie Eilish's brother has, because apparently he's the new Walter Cronkite in your world. So it's really difficult to teach kids media literacy in this environment, but it's never been more important and it's never been more difficult.
We're talking with Adam Mansbach, if you're just tuning in, the author of a number of books. You know, we know the last time we had him, he was talking about The Golan of Brooklyn. But we also know him for the award-winning book, Angry Black White Boy. And then, of course, the infamous in the bestseller, extraordinaire, that still continues to be the bestseller, Go to F to Sleep. And now the new one, Go to F to College, because the inspiration for that first book is now 18 years old. And who would have thunk that she would be at a point where she's going to college, which leads me to another question. I'm looking at the book and read it. It's good. It has the graphics in there, you know, the good illustrations and everything. But it is advice, you know, on what to do when you get to college. Does college still hold the same weight as, say, when you went to college and when we were coming up, especially with the political backdrop? Some of the elite schools have capitulated to this administration. It's become very, very expensive, right? In fact, maybe that's why you're even doing the book this time. You know, it's either Adam Mansbach does an OnlyFans page and shows his belly button, or he writes another book. But, you know, with that being said, does college, in your opinion, hold the same weight with her and her peers as it did with us?
That's a question I think about all the time. And for the record, I'm not ruling out an OnlyFans page to pay for college. We'll see how Go the After College does. And if it doesn't catch on, you might catch me on OnlyFans as well. I think everything is in flux, Dave. I think all of the structures and institutions that we have relied on for our entire lives are in disarray. Many of them, as you say, have prematurely capitulated to the Trump administration's racist demagoguery and various smoke screens through which it seeks to defund and destabilize the educational system, the healthcare system, every system that we can think of. You know, it's funny, like when Viv was applying to college, I was a lot less stressed about it than they were, because I was like, look, I've been on campuses across this country as a speaker and a guest, and I know that there are brilliant people at all of these places. And there are idiots at all of these places. And the prestige of the school does not protect you against anything. And all of these places have something to offer. But also, we're looking at a future that is so profoundly uncertain that I fully understand why kids don't want to invest in college or don't want to go into debt to go to college. The system is deeply broken. And, you know, Go the F to College is not like an endorsement of the system by any means. It's a reflection of the reality that I'm going through as a parent and that many other parents are going through. But it's less about college per se than about the feelings of watching your kid grow up and move on with their life. That's not to say I don't have specific advice about college, but when I look into the future, by no means do I think that college is necessarily going to be the only path toward a stable or a sustainable life. It's certainly no guarantee of those things. We're really teetering on the edge and the brink of a lot of disarray, uncertainty, chaos, all of it exacerbated and brought on by this malignancy sitting in the White House and the cohort of enablers that have allowed him to dismantle as much of the social safety net and as many of the elements that we have set up in this society over decades to allow people to prosper, to allow people to have a fair chance. You know, we just watched the dismantling of the Voting Rights Act 2 days ago, and this is the tip of the iceberg.
You know, as you were sitting there talking, one of the profound things that you said in the book, and I won't give all of it around, but you said pretty plainly, don't let college define you. Don't let your school define you. And it seems like such a simple thing, but it's, when I read it, I was like, how many people have led with in circles I've been in? I went to Howard. Where did you go? Oh, I went to Cal. You know, well, I went to Laney. And, you know, and then you feel like you got a kind of posture. You know, our school is the Harvard of the West. Well, you know, I went to MIT. I went to, you know, so it became like a status symbol. And not just a social thing, but also a determination as to where you would get in. There were some places that were like, if you did not graduate from these schools, you're not getting in, right? And so there was a lot of pressure and, you know, a lot of angst. And certainly if you went through the gauntlet, you'd be like, yeah, I went to Cal. I'm a Cal man. I'm a Morehouse man. I'm a Spelman woman, right? But you're saying, like, let's move away from that.
Yeah, yeah. There's a page in the book that says something like, the school you go to doesn't define you. You're much more than what you achieve. And up or down, succeed or fail, you're more loved than you'd effing believe. And at the end of the day, that's what matters, is our love for each other, our love for our children. Viv can very easily spiral into a thing where they're afraid that I'm going to be disappointed in them. They're afraid that if they don't hit some benchmark or achieve something, they're going to lose my love or my respect. And, you know, nothing could be farther than the truth. But in a pressurized environment like the one that these kids are growing up in, it bears constant reminding. And I remember being that age, and I remember one of my mentors taking me aside. I was probably a little older. I was probably in college. Maybe I was out of college. But, like, I distinctly remember every time I talked to this cat. His name is Andre Willis, still one of my best friends. But he was a teacher at my high school and a mentor of mine and, like, really the guy who put me on in so many ways. As did his wife a few years later, Trisha Rose. And I remember being in my early 20s probably, and I would like call him up and we'd talk. And every time I talked to him, I'd be like, yeah, Dre, I'm doing this and I did that and I'm achieving this and that and da 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 da. And at one point, he kind of stopped me and was like, listen, bruh, I don't care about all that. Like, I'm happy you're doing all those things. I want you to prosper and flourish and, you know, be fulfilled. But, like, understand, you're my man no matter what. You're my man if you're lying in the gutter. You're my man if you're on top of the world. And it was one of the most powerful things anybody said to me because no one had said it before. You know, my family loves me unconditionally, but they're also much more comfortable celebrating achievement and dealing with the world of accomplishment than they are with the world of emotion. So one thing that I want to get across to Viv in real life and my other kids as well, my 7 and 9-year-old, but also to the audience for Go the F to College, is this idea that we are not simply our achievements. Like, we are more than that, and those things shouldn't define us, and they do not define the amount of love that people have for us in the world or the amount of love that we have for people in the world.
You mentioned this, and also Kamal Bell in his book mentions the importance of community.
Yeah, I mean, more than ever, I think in the aftermath of the second Trump election, a lot of us came to the conclusion that we have to double down on community. We have to double down on what's local. We have to double down on the people around us. We have to keep each other safe, not just from ICE, not just from, you know, the evils that are being foisted upon us, but on a more holistic level. We have to know our neighbors. We have to look out for our neighbors. We have to be that loving community that we want to see in the world. And we're very lucky here in the Bay, luckier than many in terms of the emphasis that's always been put on community and on activism and on mutual aid. But we need to continue to teach those principles specifically to these kids as they come up and move out into the world. A thing that Viv talks about a lot as they prepare to go 3,000 miles away to school, they're thinking a lot about like Bay Area values. Like, that's a very specific and particular thing, and it's easy maybe to take for granted until you're somewhere else. The easy coupling of life with activism and art with activism and the ways that we know how to braid these things and the ways that we know how to look for each other and respond when some injustice rears its head. Like, those are important. And hopefully these kids can take those values out into the world and change wherever they're going.
If people get this book, what do you really want them to pay attention to?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I wrote Go the F to Sleep, initially, I didn't think there was going to be a big audience for it. I thought that my frustrations were just my frustrations, and maybe they were shared by a small cohort of other obnoxious parents. And what I found out was that everybody felt this way, and most people were afraid to articulate it. It was a little bit verboten. There was a culture of preciousness, and so the book provided a certain level of catharsis. It allowed people to not feel alone. It allowed people to laugh together instead of crying by themselves. And what I want this book to do is, again, articulate the complex feelings that you go through, the emotions you cycle through as you prepare to send a kid off into the world. So what I'm trying to do here really is be honest. It's a lot less of an angry book and a lot more of kind of a poignant and emotional book than Go the F to Sleep was, because the feelings are just different. So like, there's a page in the book that says something like, parenting is a lot like life. You mostly improvise it. So for all the stuff that I did wrong, I'm sorry and I'm glad you survived it. And like, that's important. It's important as a parent to acknowledge that you make mistakes and that you too are human. And the process of growing up as a kid is partly the demystification of your parents and the ability to see them as flawed human beings, not taskmasters, not perfect entities. And hopefully a page like that can speed that process along or start a certain kind of conversation. There's another page in the book that's a lot more practical, but no less important. And it's like, no pills, no powders, do not black out. These things are not good for your health. And if anybody tells you different, tell that a-hole to go F himself.
Adam Mansbach, the vulnerable, more emotionally open Adam Mansbach, talking with us as his daughter is getting ready to go 3,000 miles away, you know, to the other side of the country. To get away from you?
She'll have to go farther than that if she wants to get away from me.
But no, seriously, Go to After Sleep is the new book. And in the first one, you got Samuel Jackson, the actor, come on board and kicked off a friendship with him and got him to do it. Who's going to be the voice now? I wanted to, you know, weigh in. I'm gonna have a little bit of acting chops, you know, but I guess I didn't make the cut.
You should have asked me earlier, man. We already found somebody. No, we've been very lucky. I mean, Sam Jackson was incredible. And I've been lucky enough that, as you say, that began a series of collaborations. I got to write for Sam and direct him in an ad that was a Biden-Harris ad in 2020. I got to write for him in an Obama reelection ad in 2012. He and I did a piece together during the pandemic called Stay the F at Home that was read on the Kimmel Show and was a fundraiser for Feeding America. And then for the second book in the series, You Have to Effing Eat, we got Bryan Cranston, Walter White himself from Breaking Bad. The third book, F Now There Are Two of You. We got Larry David. So I'll be honest, I felt a certain amount of pressure to get somebody on that level. And I was like, man, I got to come correct. I got to get somebody super dope. And I am very pleased to say that we got Ted Danson, the great Ted Danson, who I've been a fan of since I was a little kid staying up late to watch Cheers, and who at 78 is still like working and iconic and also a deeply good dude. Like, I got to know him a little bit in the process. He is just an almost creepily kind person. Like, you're like, Ted Danson, are you really this nice? But he is. Like, he's actually that dude. And he did a beautiful job, lent his voice to the book. And as I said earlier, the book is a little more poignant. It's a little more elegiac. And he's got the perfect sort of timbre to communicate that sensitivity, but also knows how to hit that F-bomb.
Timbre. I gotta look that word up. What does that mean? Timbre. Don't toss SAT words at us. And I know people listen. I'm not the only one who had no idea what timbre means.
I hope I'm using it right, or even pronouncing it right. It's T-I-M-B-R-E.
Timber.
The right timber. He's cutting trees down. Nah, timbre is like vocal tone, the qualities inherent to a voice, the timbre of the voice.
Okay, there you go. Adam Mansbach, we appreciate you coming in, hanging out with us this afternoon. We wish you luck on the Go to After College book, a long line of books that you have written. And we're hoping this is very successful. I know you're going to be on the Today Show and all sorts of things. And big shout out to Viv, you know. I wanted Viv to come through here and do the interview too, but Viv is like, you know, talk to my people, talk to my agent, you know.
Viv sent a cookie, though.
Yeah, she sent a cookie, but she's also under the weather right now, so we'll have to get her in at another time. In the meantime, you take care. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.